Welcome to another edition of Shooting the Ghost. My father was a natural rebel. He rejected modernity, you know, he rejected all aspects of modernity, of television and mainstream culture. And even before that, though, I was already raised in an environment where I was being encouraged to think for myself and to not follow the herd, but I resisted that, and I thought he was full of shit. When I was a kid, all I wanted to do was fit in. And I just saw his rebellious attitude, you know, I just didn't understand it. I just couldn't figure out why he couldn't fit in and why he couldn't be sort of more normal. You know, of course, later it made a whole hell of a lot more sense to me. But when you're young, you know, one experience, he had just kind of gone off on one of his manic tangents and shaved his head completely bald. And it was the local fair, you know, with the carnival or whatever, the rides and the games and stuff. And we're walking across the street. It's him, my sister, and I. And sitting on the picnic table across the street is like, it's a small town, you know, maybe a couple thousand people. But there's the mayor, and I think it was like the chief of police and maybe like a doctor. And he saw them and he just went off. He was just like, look at you. You're fat. You disgust me. You feed off other people's misery. And I mean, you know, and then just went off on that for like a, you know, a minute or two. Just, you know, almost had to be like dragged away. He's just like, you know, you think you're king shit. You're just a big fish in a little pond. And the thing about those type of tirades, there's always an element of, well, the whole thing is true. I mean, every single word he said was true. So at the time, as a kid, I was just horrified. I just wanted to disappear. You know, looking back on it now, you know, of course, the behavior was socially unacceptable. But I see the guts that it took. And the positive side, if there is one.
Yeah. Well, apparently there is, because, I mean, Keith is the only one of us here who actually has had some success with groups, with being part of groups, right?
Yeah, I was in Boy Scouts for years and went on trips with the Scouts. But he facilitated that because he was like the Scoutmaster. And so I was in Boy Scouts and sports. You know, my dad was a big jock in high school and then into college. I mean, he was like the quarterback on the football team. He was the pitcher in the baseball team. He went to state for wrestling. At the same time, he was this very sensitive cat, you know. But I think I guess growing up in the small town, this was a way that he could gain some recognition and build some self-esteem. After college, he pretty much rejected the whole sort of jock posturing and devoted his time to mostly folk art, I guess is what you call it, working with wood carving and whittling. I think he had a real connection with trees and the woods and nature. And this was also something that he was very keen on passing on to me. I think he felt very uncomfortable around most people, and I think he found a real peace of mind in the wild and in nature. That's why he took me on those trips up to Canada with his friends. These were annual trips that were like a week long, and it was like usually him, like four of his friends, and then me. Of course, he was taking the trips before I became old enough, but then once I turned, I think it was seven, which seems pretty young. My son's eight, And I don't know if he, I can't imagine taking him on a trip like that. But yeah, these were trips in the most remote wilderness possible, really. You wouldn't see another single person or a house. You could just dip your cup into the lake from the canoe and just drink right out of there.
Were you conscious at the time or even later on? I mean, how many years were you doing these trips?
From 7 to 15.
It's a coming of age, that real period between childhood and manhood, really. So was there a point at which you became aware of just how unusual it was, like looking at your other friends and what have you?
Well, definitely by the time I was in college, I was already aware that this was an incredible gift that he had given me.
And you think it would have probably been less effective if you'd been aware of it in that light at the time, maybe.
That's hard to say.
I mean, do you think it was that for the other men, or I mean, or do you think the other men were aware of it? Because you were the only kid there, right?
Initially, and then after a couple of years, then one of the guys had like a little brother. He was like a big brother and had a little brother. You know, kind of take a kid who maybe doesn't have a father and kind of take him under your wing and take him out and stuff. He brought his little brother up. And then towards the end, one of the other guys' son was old enough to go. So then it become almost like a tradition where once the sons are old enough, then we take them up.
Which must have made a big difference if you weren't the only kid, yeah.
Right. And I guess there was a certain amount of a feeling of that my territory had been invaded.
Right. So you wouldn't be the special one then.
But then at the same time, I had, you know, then I had someone who I could sort of show the way and show how to start a fire and how to
Oh, wow.
do different things. So even that was passed on.
Right. And what about the women? I mean, the absence of women. Were you aware of that at the time? Or was it talked about? Or did you go whoring?
Well, these trips, no, there were definitely no women. And it was just sort of unspoken. These were not the first trips that my dad made up to the wild. He actually made trips while he was in college with his jock buddies. These were different guys. And in this case, as my mother tells me, it was made very explicit. And they rubbed it in the girlfriends' and the wives' noses. You know, like, you're not going, you couldn't handle it, and you know, a bunch of bullshit like that, and it was just really disgusting the way they sort of flaunted the fact that they were going to do this thing. And you know, but he was 20, 21, you know, he was younger. I think by the time he took me up, he was in his, well, he was almost 30, I guess, or in his late 20s. And plus, these guys were different. The guys that he was going on the trips when I was going, they were more kind of down to earth, kind of farm raised kids who were maybe didn't have the experience of the wild like my dad did, but in some ways they were almost more deeply connected to nature and to the earth through their experience growing up on a farm, which my dad didn't.
So did this ring bells for you then? You mentioned like when you first saw Peckinpah films or particularly The Wild Bunch or films of that nature, did it kind of take you back to that time or did you recognize something in those films that you had seen for yourself?
Without a doubt, just the way they carried themselves, the way they talked to each other, the sort of humor, you know, the scenes where they're sitting around the campfire with Pike and Borgnine. I immediately recognized my dad and his friends, the way they connected to each other. That was something that I never saw it anywhere else. I didn't see it in sort of normal everyday life. It just never happened.
So do you feel like you were aspiring to that thereafter, like to find the similar kind of dynamic among men?
Absolutely. I guess, and that I wasn't fully conscious of until later, but I just felt drawn to create sort of a small band of four or five guys. And I had no, I guess I at the time I didn't even have any idea why. Of course, I guess now it seems more obvious, but I always had that sort of ideal that this could be something that you could create. And I was able to sort of do that. In high school, there was sort of four or five of us, and we would always go and shoot pool. And then in sort of later high school, after I moved to a different school, then I sort of fell into this group of four or five guys who we went out every weekend to the little teen disco and would drink Mickey's Big Mouse and just try to pick up girls and bring them back to whoever house, you know, was open. And then in college, it was centered on psychedelics and that sort of thing, and music. And
but was it also kind of focused around men? Was there a conscious omission of women in that?
In all three of those instances, it was the focus was the men and the sort of band of guys that formed a sort of energy that then could spin off and attract women or whatever.
Right. Do you think it has anything, something to do with trying to get free of the mother's influence, like strength in numbers? Because you said how your mother disliked and even kind of resisted your father's taking you on those bonding things, right?
I think she was a bit jealous. I think she didn't have any sort of equivalent to that. And for my dad, this was a big deal. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, pick up and go. I mean, there was the planning and the planning sessions, and you sit around and you plan out the menu and the course and who's going to be responsible for getting the gear. And this would take a couple of months. So even though it was an annual thing, his sort of energy would be focused on it for maybe almost half a year.
Right. But you said he wasn't an intellectual type, your father, at all.
No, I mean, his heroes were Walt Whitman and Thoreau.
Hemingway?
Mainly Whitman, Thoreau, Emerson.
He did read, then.
Well, he did, yes, he did. I mean, he did read, of course. But he didn't see himself as smart or an intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
He was an artist, but even there, he wasn't... This was folk art, and it wasn't about refinement. It was, in fact, the opposite. I mean, he would always... talk about how it's important to leave flaws in your work.
You know, you mentioned that in that context, that your father's intellect wasn't that developed. Maybe that was his strength, you know? If his primal self was dominant, that would allow him to be dominant within the marriage, because those are the primal roles. And the intellect, wouldn't you say, is actually a way to divorce ourselves from our primal nature. So maybe you just kind of hit upon something that was the very essence of what made him able to be dominant and upright in the way that you're describing. It's kind of like the men that we were describing earlier, these actors, that they weren't dummies either, but they had this sort of persona, this way of being that they created, which was very physical. It was very close to macho, but it wasn't. It was more sophisticated than macho, or it was just more natural, more, you know, less of a pose. There was an element of a pose to it. And I think it was similar to some extent, wouldn't you say, Phil, that they kind of rejected that sort of intellectual way of being in favor of a more primal, more old-fashioned way, you might say.
Well, of course, Lee Marvin, I mean, I think his father was a lawyer, probably similar to Peckinpah's father in some ways. And his mother was an editor at Vogue magazine, an upper-class family in New York. So he had some refinement to him. He was an intelligent guy. Later on, he was interested in philosophy, Buddhism, and, you know, Eastern philosophies. But he wouldn't talk about stuff like that in interviews or with other people. You just hear little mentions of it.
Mm.
Now, if you read bios, it talks about his interest in that. He was part of some sort of a group that worked with mainly vets who dealt with anger issues. They held symposiums, a group of Jungians in Texas. Harry Wilmer was his name. So he had that side. And then there was Warren Oates. He wrote poetry and played the guitar. And I think he wrote songs and sang those. You know, he had this poetic side. But he also was known for getting all drunked up and, you know, chasing people down a street with a knife. So he had both of those sort of sides. And then there's Mitchum, who wrote poetry and he sang. I mean, he recorded an album. Not that that, you know, shows that he was an artist or sensitive. But, you know, He did do some singing, you know, and he sang the title song for Thunder Road. And, you know, he did write poetry. He wrote poetry before he was an actor. When he was, I think he was an assistant to a magician or a mentalist or something like that. And then he was like on a chain gang. And, you know, he had this wide variety of experiences. Right. And of course, there's guys like Coburn who was, you know, he played the fucking gong, you know. He was known for coming on Johnny Carson, you know, back in the 60s and early 70s. And he, you know, I guess he'd like wear like a robe and play the gong. And he actually did that in the movie The President's Analyst, a little bit of his gong playing. You know, he studied martial arts under Bruce Lee. So he was sort of a philosopher kind of guy, you know. So They all had these sides. I mean.
So and they didn't even hide them is what you're saying. Right. It's just that the persona that they created was so sort of arresting that It kind of obscured these other sides, which they were quite open about. But
Yeah, I mean, people who would stereotype them would be surprised, but people who really understood the depth of something like they were actually doing would not be all that surprised. Like, to me, it wasn't a surprise, you know, to read these things about these guys. It's like, well, of course, naturally, you know, that just follows.
Because to you, it shows, yeah. I mean, you can detect it.
Exactly, and somebody just hearing the Hollywood bullshit and doing the whole star celebrity worship sort of thing would be surprised because, of course, all the publicity would not kind of mention that.
Well, so what Keith's been saying about his father, So this is the difference between an artist who kind of downplays that artistic poetic side and one who plays it up. So you've got the artsy-fartsy type, and then you got the no-bullshit type.
Exactly. Again, you have the fakes and the real people, you know. And, you know, I mean, to hear Keith talk about his dad, I mean, he read books, you know, Thoreau and Whitman. It's like, well, my dad did. Well, he read a few books here and there. But, I mean, no, that's an intellectual.
Right.
In the circles that I would come to know, you know, not an intellectual. It's not an intellectual. You know, an intellectual intellectualizes things. It's more a real, authentic intelligence than like a fake, learned, scholarly sort of bookish sort of intelligence. Not the book smart sort of thing. Of course, book smarts are actual smarts. But, you know, there's a difference between someone who really gets the heart of something, you know, and doesn't need to speak about it so much.
Right.
And someone who can't really get the heart, so all I can do is dance around the edges. So they do a lot of talking about the periphery. And I have to admit that I feel like I'm kind of more of the bullshitter who talks around things and doesn't really get to the heart of them kind of thing.
No, I think you're more like the kind of tough guys that we're talking about, Phil, because you put this persona forward, this hard-edged, acerbic persona. But underneath that, we all know that there's this poetic, artistic, sensitive
struggling
nature.
Well, right? One thing that I was struck by, as you know, listening to Keith talk about those experiences with his father, it's like, okay, of the three of us, Keith is the only guy who had experiences like that. Of the three of us, Keith is the only guy who's reproduced, you know what I mean? Supposedly stereotypical. It is somebody supposedly real. It really is the normal sort of, you know, structure, family sort of structure. I mean, I'm married. I've been with the same woman for 22 plus years now, but both of us refuse to have kids. That's one of the things we bonded about, you know, absolute refusal to reproduce and actually join that life because we weren't set up to actually do it, you know. But I mean, we all have our fucked up side, but, you know, there's a certain something that needs to be built in. I mean, I think Keith's father was doing precisely the right thing to give him a good foundation for later.
Yeah, well, because it brings back to what we talked about before with these little mini consensuses of freaks or misfits and how they're drawn together by their common experience of dysfunctional families and all the rest of it. So basically, we're talking about individuals who just can't fit in because they don't see anything worth fitting in with. No, so it's like if you reject what you see as a way of life, that gives you a certain kind of identity and that can lead you to gravitate to others like that. But do you actually have a sense of a way that does work? Chances are that you don't. So then you get these collectives of misfits who they're brought together by something real, but they don't necessarily have any alternative way of being together. So then they often end up just being just this, a sort of group of fucked up freaks or drunks or whatever it is. So Keith would be the exception there. And we're all Aries, so we all have the potential to be group leaders, but Keith's the only one who's really kind of acted it out in a way that seems kind of natural, or certainly you were doing so at a very early age. And so it probably does come back to that, that not only did you grow up in a dysfunctional family, but at the same time, simultaneously, you were being allowed to see a way of being that, that was functional, even if it didn't have any women in it. I guess that's a key point, isn't it? Yeah. It only worked when there were no women there. So, I mean, maybe that was, so it was a way of retaining their integrity as much as they could within that world, was to create a very coarse, kind of brutal persona that would protect that. It's sort of the cliche, isn't it? The guy who's got the tough exterior and the soft, sensitive, intelligent interior. But if it's a cliche, I mean, it's presumably because it is a sort of archetypal way of being. Yeah, and Sam was, I mean, he really was a living example of that, because Sam was a very refined intellect. He studied theatre and he was an artistic soul. And of course it shows in his movies, even though the subject matter of the movies is kind of opposed to that. It's there, and that's what makes The Wild Bunch particularly, but even some of the lesser movies have this incredible poignancy, because they do bring those two worlds together and show how the tough exterior does protect this poetic nature within. And that was how he was, of course, as a man. He created this persona as the Hollywood maverick film director who was a good whore, who would go where he was kicked. Of course, the irony of that, that he was always saying, was that he wasn't. He was a lousy whore, you know. and I think he did consciously what most of us do unconsciously, in that he created a sort of character armor, which was the drinking, whore-fucking, you know, belligerent, macho, cowboy, knife-throwing bruiser, which wasn't what he was like at all. But he embodied that, and it wasn't fake either. That's the thing. It was a side of him, but he brought it to the exterior. You know, he emphasized those qualities in order to create that exterior that potentially would give him like a way of being within that world. He could retain his integrity thereby. Because Sam was set against the Hollywood system, right? That was what his life embodied, in a very different way to Orson Welles. I mean, Orson Welles didn't set out to, well, I guess he did unconsciously, but basically he turned the system into his enemy, you know, and he couldn't work. And Sam did something similar, but in a very different way. I mean, Orson Welles actually bit the hand that fed him, and he did this expose on Randolph Hearst, who's one of the power individuals in that industry. So he did set himself up, whereas Peckinpah, it's still something of a mystery how he actually ended up blacklisted. I don't know about you, Keith, but Phil probably knows a lot of the biographical stuff there. There are ostensible causes for why Sam ended up blacklisted by the time that he finally made Wild Bunch, or rather the Wild Bunch was the way that he actually made it out of blacklisting. But during his prime, he wasn't able to work. And there are ostensible reasons for this. You know, he got fired off the Cincinnati Kid. But it all comes down to him just being unruly. He wasn't one to be controlled. He wouldn't do what he was told. So, you know, there'll be a subtler backstory there that we don't know about that led to his being blacklisted, to his being unable to work. But, you know, if we bring it to the real essence of it, it wouldn't really matter. I mean, all of that, these would just be effects, these would just be details of how it played out. It would actually be something in Sam's nature, wouldn't it? That, like we were saying before, he simply wouldn't be able to fit in with the system. He wouldn't be able to go with the flow, and so he would just be creating his own direction by pushing against the flow. And that would create all this opposition and resistance, but at the same time that would attract other individuals who were trying to do the same or having to do the same within that same industry. So, but particularly actors. I mean, he was a filmmaker, so he was going to work with actors, and so he was naturally drawn to these kind of actors, the James Coburn, Lee Marvin kind of actor, who wasn't playing ball, who wasn't into the method, who wasn't, who was. Well, I guess what we're describing, and it has to do with this retaining manhood, trying to stay upright in an industry that basically wants you flat on your back, you know, or on your hands and knees with your mouth open kind of industry. You know? And these were men who were managing to stay upright and still be successful. You know, they were strong enough not to actually be destroyed by their opposition, you know, by their refusal to bend. And so, you know, maybe what Sam was doing was a great sorcery, and an impossible sorcery. He was actually trying to create his own consensus, and the Wild Bunch, within the greater consensus of Hollywood, which is in a way like the consensus, isn't it? If we want to go back to the mind control thing, it's like, you know, the center point, the heart of darkness of our Western culture is there, kind of encapsulated or concentrated in the Hollywood community. So imagine what it's like actually working within that. And that Sam was to survive at all, although of course he couldn't survive anyway, but even for a little while, he had to somehow create his own consensus, which would entail finding like minds, kindred spirits, who were united, unified by their refusal to be integrated within the Hollywood system. So then there was this mini consensus within the Hollywood thing, and then you get a film like The Wild Bunch, which not only is this remarkable work of art, which somehow shouldn't have come out of Hollywood, like a Trojan horse, because it's just an action western movie, but with this incredible depth. This happens, but then also The Wild Bunch is even about that, in a different way, a different time, but still, these men who refuse to bow down to the encroach of technology and progress and all the rest of it, and they have to become bandits, because that's all there is for them. They're not going to become soldiers. So then they have to put this brutal, coarse aspect of themselves, they have to put it forward, and then they become killers, you know, because that's, The Wild Bunch shows it when you take it to its extreme. It's not just men going into the wilderness to bond and being manly, or not to bond, but, you know, to be together. It's actually, almost psychopathic, really. I mean.
Just thinking about my dad, you know, he had this connection with wood, not only in his art, but going out and cutting wood and selling it for firewood. He would find farmers or whatever who had land that had trees on it. I mean, he loved just getting out into nature and getting just drenched in sweat and sawdust. And I thought he was insane. I mean, I thought this was just hell, but he loved it. And this was also something that he showed me when we would drive around and talk to farmers about whether they had trees, you know, that they would want cut or whatever. I just remember him saying, like, driving in a truck, he's like, you know, when you're talking to a farmer, you know, you got to get on their level. You got to, you know, pick up a blade of grass and, you know, chew on it and spit and, you know, whatever.
That kind of reminds me of that, the difference in the two acting styles. I mean, that would be more of a tough guy acting style sort of thing. You know, we don't get into how the farmer feels, but, you know, you pick up a blade of grass and, you know, spit, and you learn to follow along with the movements, you know, more than really think too much about the interior of it.
That, yeah,
right.
Carries you into the interiors.
Well, it's kind of like being in the body rather than being in the head or the emotions, isn't it? Because we all know how to be like the farmer chewing on a piece of grass, because it's in our genes. You know, it's just like having a direct connection to the earth. We may not feel that we have that because we're in our head and our feelings, but our body is still right there. And so if we actually pick up the grass and chew it or spit or start acting in a more coarse, if you like, way, or more kind of primal way, then we'll actually start feeling that. So again, from the outside in.
Actually, the tough guy actors were, you know, relatively athletic, all of them.
Mm. So, I mean, it's like a survival thing, you know, I mean, for a farmer or somebody who works the land and what have you. And the thing about artists is I think so many of them, although they love being artists, they really kind of envy and aspire to just being natural men, because there's something about that that you kind of lose touch with if you become too sophisticated. So, and then if you're in an environment like Hollywood or any kind of artistic quote unquote culture, you really stand to lose touch with that because it's just not, you know, part of the lifestyle. And so then bring it back to Sam, like how, and these other characters, how they created this exterior that was almost anti-intellectual, anti-artistic, even though they weren't. They were intellectual beings and artists, but they created this way of being a bit like the, you know, the more like the natural man, even if it was a kind of distorted, whore-fucking, boozing kind of natural man, but still it was going back to that primal thing as a way to survive, really, being in that environment, a way to stay connected to the primal nature and connected to the earth, maybe, even. And that was Sam's experience, and I mean, that in Hollywood, because, of course, Hollywood isn't run by men either. It's not a world where men operate or function. Why would they? Yeah, what man would want to be an actor? And this was the thing that tormented Brando to the end of his days, is that he didn't feel like a real man. I'm really filling in the gaps here. He never quite said that, but he definitely said that acting was not a profession for a man. It was not a manly thing to do. And I think many actors feel like, or felt like that. I think we've reached this, you know, sort of evolution of the thing where it's almost gone beyond that, like to even be in touch enough with one's primal self to be aware of that is probably becoming lost now. But certainly in Sam's time, I think there was an acute sense of that, that for a man, for an upright man, and it's very ironic for us to be talking about real men, you know, because I don't think any of us are the, you know, are the kind of survive in the wilderness hunter warrior kind of guy in the old fashioned sense, and yet we're drawn together by a fascination for Peckinpah movies. And it's the thing, I mean, Sam wasn't either, really. He was raised in that time, so he could have been that kind of man, but he was creative, poetic, so he became an artist. Same with Lee Marvin was a soldier, he was made of that stuff, but he became an actor. And so they're sort of seeing the overlap of two worlds and two times, and the masculine and the feminine, and the struggle there. That kind of energy, or that kind of intent, or that kind of integrity to survive within a world in which there are no men, you know. And so a man, and particularly men who are grouping together, like integrating within the greater consensus, would be seen as a threat. As you know, the most formidable threat there was, and it would have to be crushed. And Sam was crushed, you know, and even Lee Marvin was crushed, wouldn't you say? I mean, maybe not crushed to the same extent, but I mean, his career was in ruins by the time he died, wasn't it?
Yeah, he didn't have any more good, you know, there were no films that he was fit to really be in. Everything was basically garbage, but he just did it for the paycheck. Mm-hmm. And that was why it was, if you want to call it, in ruins. And he was also older. He couldn't really, you know, at that point he was old and he was starting to suffer from some of the ill health effects that would eventually kill him, mainly due to his hard living in his younger days, you know, hell raising and drinking and everything.
Right.
So, you know, he had no choice. It's like, but he still sort of exuded a certain personality, and Hollywood was only offering garbage crap films like Delta Force with fucking Chuck Norris, who is a tough guy only in jokes. Is he a tough guy? But as an actual tough guy, he totally failed as a tough guy. He's very...
Yeah, but I mean, if you compare him to Clint Eastwood or something like that, okay, Clint directs his movies, but you know, these, or even Paul Newman, who just kept it going to the end to the point that he died, lived a legend and died a legend, you know, in a superficial way. Well, we're just talking about Hollywood.
But there's a lot more control on their careers, where Lee Marvin just lived his life like just an actor for hire kind of thing. And he always made kind of crappy movies, you know, he's always... Mm. If I sit and I look at all the films he made, I mean, a lot of times I got to work my ass off to make them something that are really interesting to me, other than the fact that Lee Marvin's in them, you know. Cat House Thursday, you know, it's just basically a bad replay of Cat Ballou, which has a lot of good points and everything, but it's kind of dated and it doesn't really have the same comedic impact it did before. But, you know,
sure.
For whatever you feel about Cat Ballou, it's a shadow of that, you know. Mm. There's just so many garbage films that he made that, you know, not total garbage, but just not interesting. Monty Walsh, you know, who really cares about that?
Well, isn't it a strange sort of irony then? Because you could make an argument for what Lee Marvin did as a kind of integrity. He just gave up trying to actually be anything in Hollywood, and yeah, he still needed the money, so he'd take the paycheck. That, I mean, that's the sort of classic case of somebody who sold out. That's how most people would see that. But what if, it, in a sense, the reverse was the case, that was the only way that he could actually somehow retain his self-respect was by totally turning his back on his whole ambition, his whole desire to somehow be somebody within that system, realizing that it just wasn't possible. And so, well, okay, it doesn't make any difference what kind of movie he makes at that point, because at least if he's not invested in it in any way, then it's not going to suck the life out of him. Because Brando did the same, didn't he? And then you look at somebody like Jack Nicholson, to bring him up again, because his career seems to take a nosedive like within 5 years or something. And he, interesting, Nicholson sort of embodies some of the qualities we've been talking about. I was thinking when we were talking about Keith's father and that kind of guy, that Bobby Dupere in Five Easy Pieces is really sort of archetypal portrait of that kind of guy, who reminds me a lot of Phil, by the way. I've told Phil this. And Phil does have these qualities too, of this putting outside, you know, keeping that sensitive, creative, intelligent, poetic side. In Bobby Dupere's case, he's a pianist, keeping it hidden and creating a persona which is brash, which is coarse, which is cynical, which rejects. That was you know, something that Nicholson, he really could have tuned that to a fine art in the brief period that he was this iconic actor. And then very quickly his career just sort of, well, his career was fine. He's a legend to this day, but he stopped making decent movies, yeah. And he stopped acting in that way. He stopped, like, becoming... he was no longer this very intense, brooding kind of method-type actor who totally embodied the characters. He started becoming something of a parody, but in a much more subtle way than Brando, who did it, like, so overtly that he became a joke. And his career just bottomed out until The Godfather. Nicholson somehow managed to actually keep his career alive so that very few people have noticed, and of course you could say it's a matter of opinion, but I wouldn't, of course, that he hasn't really done any good movies, hardly any good movies since Cuckoo's Nest. And he'll do some real stinkers, you know, I mean, real. They destroyed Dustin Hoffman's career, you know. Look at Hoffman, he did a few stinkers and he was out, you know. Three strikes and you're out. Whereas Nicholson somehow, I think because he was more of a sorcerer and he was doing it maybe in the way that we're describing what Lee Marvin did. He's like, you're not going to have my soul. It's not worth it, you know. But he was able to somehow give very little to his movies or performances and yet still ride that wave and stay on. Well, maybe he came up with a more sophisticated, well, not sophisticated, but that too maybe, but more effective exterior than Sam and the others, in that he created this persona which was just like this pig in shit celebrity. That's what you get with Nicholson, isn't it? This shit eating grin. I'm Jack Nicholson and I love it, you know. And the irony is that you kind of look at that and think, God, I wish I was Jack Nicholson. But actually, no, I mean, it's like only Jack Nicholson could handle being Jack Nicholson. That's why he's Jack Nicholson, you know. It's like, It's so rare. I mean, there's a reason why he's a legend, and it's not to do with the movies he makes or even the performances he gives, because they're pretty hit and miss, you know. I think it's to do with that he's perfected. His greatest performance is himself, you know, the public persona. That was kind of a possible theory that we were putting forward as to why these certain individuals, actors, chose not to go method, chose to be old school, to hold on to that, the old code, just like Peckinpah's characters, the old way of life, in order not to get swallowed up by that system, just as in The Wild Bunch, they become more and more rebellious, you know, and more psychopathic, in a sense, as just a way not to be integrated by the encroaching modernity, you know, of the West. Thank you.
Well, I was thinking about how it seems, if you look at Nicholson's career, as far as him sort of turning a new leaf in his style or his approach to acting, it happened in the mid-80s, and then certainly by the time of Batman, he had completely transformed into a totally different creature, where it's just...
Maybe literally.
Yeah, it's just complete makeup, and there's just nothing... There's nothing underneath it. And then there's that famous quote, I guess, where Nicholson had claimed that he warned Heath Ledger before he took on the role of the Joker. And then, of course, that became, you know, more important after he was discovered dead. But to me, it's just interesting that, of course, we don't know what happened with Ledger. He did, I guess the filming of the picture was complete when he died, but it sure feels like there's a connection there. And that Nicholson, you know, was, I guess, in some ways smart enough to have avoided that through this process of kind of not emotionally investing himself into the role, but just playing it like a clown. Whereas from watching Ledger's performance, that he put absolutely everything he had into the role.
Mm-hmm. And it consumed him.
It appears that it did.
Yeah.
Something did, anyway. It was cryptic, wasn't it? Because we don't know what Jack said to Heath, but he said afterwards that I warned him. That was all he said. So yeah, that it was assumed that it was something to do with Ledger taking on that role and how it would take over his psyche, and I'm sure that was a big part of it, but there could have been other factors at play. But yeah, I mean, that's a telling example, isn't it? Because if Nicholson warned Ledger about it, it would have been because he knew that Ledger was probably going to take on the role in a way that he hadn't. I mean, Nicholson's Joker performance was a buffoonish. There was no depth to it at all. I mean, talk about finding your character in the costume. He just put on the makeup and started jumping around and being Jack Nicholson, only, you know, with a goofy grin kind of thing, you know. And so he got away clean with 10 million or 30 million or 100 million, whatever the hell it was, whereas Ledger gave this incredibly intense performance, which was brilliant, I thought. But he's not here to reap the rewards of that.
It's that old trickster energy, you know?
Mm.
That deeper sort of version of a clown.
Mm-hmm.
The method version versus the tough guy acting from without, just copying the outside and acting as if he were just a clown.
The thing about the Joker is he's an archetypal character, a comic book character. So if you're going to make him real in your psyche, then you would have to be opening to archetypal forces, because he's not a real person, is he?
Mm-hmm.
Nope. Well, it's a very archetypal. I mean, that's when they make quality Batman product, is when they really get into the heart of the whole archetypal nature of that conflict. You know, Batman and the Dark Knight, and how Batman's appearance literally manifest the Joker, because now that he's ramped up the battle to that level, now of course the opposite is going to, you know, ramp itself up to that same level. What do you get? You get the Joker.
Well, yeah, like a polarity force that manifests first one pole and then the other pole has to come into being.
Mm-hmm. Or what is it? The principle for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, or whatever. Yeah,
Newton's law.
Yeah. Well, and Christian Bale had his meltdown too, didn't he? So
yeah.
Watch this space, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, because Nicholson, he would definitely be an interesting case study, because his career goes back to that very critical time in the 60s, you know, and he was struggling for a long time. And he was in the Roger Corman school, so that's an example of the mini consensus within the greater consensus of Hollywood. But he's a really intelligent guy. I mean, if you read the right interview, then he's no dummy, you know. And so, again, this persona that he creates is a sort of hedonistic, fun-loving, baseball-watching, kind of beer-drinking guy. It's just that. It's a persona.
Well, sure. He developed this persona in the 1980s.
Well, I say, you can even go back to Cuckoo's Nest, really. He's got Missouri Breaks. Okay, so his first film after Cuckoo's Nest was with Brando. Because Brando was, and it's funny, whenever I think of One-Eyed Jacks, I keep thinking Nicholson's in it, but I guess because of the title. But Brando and Nicholson, I mean, young Brando and young Nicholson, they do sort of overlap in some weird way in my mind, anyway. So Peckinpah was hired to write the script, and Kubrick was hired to direct, but basically Brando was running the show. And Brando fired both of them and took over and directed the film himself. But Sam put a lot into that script, and so hence that Brando taught him to hate, you know. So then we, to tie in with Nicholson, when Nicholson worked with Brando on Missouri Breaks, Brando was really fucking with Nicholson, and I guess sounded like sort of trying to break him down, because he would have, you know, Nicholson would be ready to shoot and he'd be sitting in a puddle of shit in the cold weather or whatever, and Brando would be in his trailer, you know, getting ready for an hour while Nicholson was waiting. You know, and of course there would have been this power play between the two men, because Nicholson was actually at the peak while Brando was really on the way out. So there's going to be that real power dynamic between them. And then, of course, when Brando did come out, he came out in a woman's dress. You
know, yeah.
Created this totally fucked up character that makes the film interesting just for what the hell Brando's doing, you know. But
so Nicholson's career made a shift after Cuckoo's Nest. But you have to remember, Cuckoo's Nest was 1975, the same year as Jaws. And then a couple of years later, we have Star Wars, and the whole industry is shocked by the blockbuster phenomenon. And
Right. And so you could say Nicholson got with that agenda right then. I mean, he saw what was coming, and so he stopped trying to be an artist in the same way.
And in the same time period, we have Brando doing Superman.
Good point. Well, of course, Brando had already pretty much stopped anyway, but he made that comeback with Godfather, and then he did Last Tango. And after Last Tango, he said he would never again do that kind of performance, because it was just like being mentally raped, he said. I don't know if he used that term, but that was basically what he was saying, was that it's psychic.
Well, we're back to the trauma-based mind control.
Yeah, except, of course, it's with an actor actually does the work themselves. That would be the beauty of it, that they're basically, yeah.
Just surrendering themselves to the role.
Well, yeah, I mean, and they can get a great performance, but the thing is, And you can get a movie like Last Tango or Taxi Driver or Cuckoo's Nest with just these phenomenal performances, or, you know, embodiments of, it's like a character is created, a tulpa even, you know. It's like Travis Bickle is more real than Robert De Niro, you know, in a way. He is to me, anyway.
Sure.
So there's something, there's a real sorcery happening there. But, you know, aside from the creative process, then there's the greater corporate process, which is the Taxi Driver, whatever, is a product within this system. And so it's just a small component, and it's kind of that's allowed to happen, that these great movies are allowed to be made and to be released, because that actually strengthens the power of Hollywood, even though they don't necessarily make money through them, and they're definitely not necessarily effective as brainwashing tools, because these are works of art. They would tend to wake people up and sensitize people, but in the long run they can be effective because they give Hollywood credibility, so people continue to pay attention. If there's one movie like Taxi Driver every 10 years, fuck, that's enough to keep looking, you know.
So the art that comes out of Hollywood is not by design. In fact, it's the chaos that the system is unable to control.
But if they didn't create any art, then they wouldn't have survived this long, would they? Or at least they wouldn't have the credibility that they still have to this day. People still think that, you know, Hollywood's about making... Nobody thinks it's about making art, but people think that it is at least about trying to make art.